special guest Mike Carey. He's one of my favorite people in the business, maybe on the planet. And he's so handsome, I wanted to make a video. How's that, Mike?
It's good. I just got a haircut the other day, so you're lucky.
It's perfect. Or as my son would say, you got them all cut.
I'm much more aerodynamic.
Yeah, that's his big joke. So I wanted to have you on today. Let's get you introduced. Mike is a vice president with TransOn Auction Properties. And Mike and I worked together for a number of years liquidating bank assets, foreclosure auctions, REO sales, and this kind of thing. Mike, what do you think if you could take an estimate, what do you think you've sold volume-wise for banks?
The last 24 months, we've had our busiest years ever, and we've been involved in over 3,500 transactions.
3,500.
Yeah, in the 10 years that I've been doing this, I think I've probably sold close to probably 10,000 pieces of real estate, you know, and at some level, everything from $5,000 pieces of land to, you know, the Point Breeze or Broadlux, you know, $18 million kind of development opportunities.
Sure. Yeah, those were fun ones. So that's what we talk about here on this show, is we have experts come on and help educate the subscribers and the folks who tune into this show about how to work with lenders, how to work with banks in their REO and their notes and foreclosures and whatnot. And so I'm thrilled to have you here. And I hope that what I'd like to do is go through and pick your brain a little bit about a few things here. I'm sorry, I keep looking off on the left. That's where I've got my notes. I want to take you through here so that when we get to the end, there's some takeaways that people are able to go forward and say, well, this is what I need to do. This is what I need to do better in my business. And then, you know, the other thing is that you're selling thousands of properties up and down the coast. People should reach out to you. We'll talk about how to do that so that if they want to participate in your sales or, you know, whatever else it is. So that's kind of the goals for today. So, So talk to me about working with banks. Who are you typically talking with? Like, what are their titles and their roles?
Yeah, I mean, my guys typically have something. I mean, some of them are just vice presidents. You know, every bank has 1,000 vice presidents.
Right.
But typically their department or title has the word special asset or workout in it. Sometimes REO manager, but typically you know, special asset managers, VP of special assets, you know, workout officer, as most of the time my folks end up with that, and that's what I search for when I'm looking for new clients.
Okay. And so so let's talk about what's important to that kind of person, because I think what happens for a lot of the folks who I talk to who've been in real estate for a while, they're used to dealing with private sellers, private clients, people who own the real estate, and a lot of times they have some kind of attachment to it and all that. And I know, you know, from experience that it's very different when it's part of your job in dealing with that. And so that being the case, then what is important when you're dealing with somebody who's, you know, a special assets manager who's got a stack of files on their desk?
Yeah. I mean, I think the overarching, the biggest thing is that they understand that while you're paid, while I get paid based on selling things, that at the same time I'm not in every transaction to tell them to sell. And so sometimes I make a recommendation that says, they say, look, I got a retail development in Massachusetts. I'm owed $2.5 million. The borrowers have put $2 million on the table. Should I go to auction with it, or should I take the $2 million? And you know, while I love retail development today, I looked at the asset for them. I looked at where it was. I looked at what it was doing, and I eventually told them, "You should take the $2 million, and not hire me."
Right. So you talked yourself out of a commission.
I talked myself out of a job.
Yeah.
and a good commission for me. I mean, that's a good, I like that sale. You know, that's a great, that's my price point. And that's my property. I got a lot of buyers that are looking for things like that.
So why would you do that?
Because I want the guy to call me again the next time when he's got an asset to sell, and it is an auction property, and he doesn't have the right deal on the table. And I say, well, let's go to auction with it and see what happens.
Right.
And I know that they're going to call me, and they know that I'm going to give them my best counsel, whether that is in my best interest or not.
So is that...
You know, these guys have... Go ahead.
I was going to say...
These guys have... You know...
I did it again.
They have piles of assets. And I say guys. I mean, most of the time, the folks that I work with, it's a pretty male-dominated world still.
Sure.
There are some women. I'd love to see more women in the workout world, but
yeah.
It does end up being guys, so I don't mean to generalize there, but that's kind of the demographic. You know, they have piles of assets and they're working through them. And the guys that are thoughtful about it, it's not a numbers analysis,
yeah,
necessarily.
Okay.
And there are always layers, meaning, is there a guarantee? How deep can they go? Are there other assets that they can potentially chase if they move through this one? And so it's not always just a cut and dry. Here's my appraisal value. Knock 22% off of that, minus taxes, minus you know, legal costs, and here's my reserve. You know?
Right, and so they've got a bunch of different factors they have to weigh. You're saying so. In addition to, I get the one point where they want to have somebody who they can count on, and they know that the counsel that they're getting from you is the best, you know, for that particular situation. But what else are they struggling with? Like, what's important to them? You know, if you could talk in terms of, like, do they have, are there timelines? Is there any reporting or that we should know about or anything like that that happens internally that you have to kind of play through?
I mean, these guys are always up against the wall in terms of time. Typically, the workout guys that I'm working with, when the loan lands on their plate, it's already been on the retail side for a little bit. The original loan officer has typically been managing a relationship for a while. You know, they either get it after it's had a major implosion and it's all crisis, or it's really headed close to implosion. You know, banks don't overstaff workout offices and departments because they're a liability from an accounting standpoint. You know, they're expensive.
Sure.
Not a revenue generator.
Right.
They don't like you know, giving them too much overhead. And so, you know, these guys are typically running from one project to a next. And, you know, in terms of reporting, I mean, you are more an expert on terms of when, you know, FDIC cares, when those things run in. I can't tell you that I'm, you know, intimately involved in that, though I do know that there are ebbs and flows depending on the bank's balance sheet. When I talk to guys, their world, sometimes they're getting a lot of pressure,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're not. And so I can't quite tell you that I know why they're getting pressure at certain moments. I recently had a client who has, from the top, they put a 90-day moratorium on foreclosures, and I honestly don't know why, and I don't think they really knew why, but it came down from HQ that basically said, we're not going to foreclose for 90 days on anything. What that's all about,
just
I don't
taking
know.
A breather, maybe reviewing their processes doesn't. Well, that's interesting. And so how often is it that the person that you're dealing with is able to make the final decision on a release price for you, as opposed to them having to go up the chain or committee or something like that?
It really depends on the size of the bank and the parameters of the deal. Depending on the, you know, the capital size of the bank, most of my guys have a lot of flexibility up to a certain point.
Okay.
And then at some point, they have to go to their boss or their boss's boss to get approvals to do things. But my most of the folks that I work with seem to be empowered up to a point.
Okay.
And then when things go, I mean, when paper value very much differs from real world value, then they need to go get permissions from a committee or from a manager or from, you know, and stuff. Some banks, the president of the bank, you know, depending on the size of how they work.
Right.
And so local, you know, community banks, the president is intimately involved in most distressed credits. You know, when you're at a regional bank size, they definitely compartmentalize more, and they have a, you know, their workout division is relatively independent from the, you know, retail side of what they do.
Okay.
So it's very different. Yeah.
So what else goes into how they make decisions? If you can, I know, you know, there are some time pressures because they, you know, they're closing out on their quarters. We know that they've got they might get directives that come down, like you talked about the foreclosure moratorium, or they might have their limits that they need to stay within before they need to go get, you know, permission to do a deal. What else weighs into how they decide whether or not they're going to take a deal that you bring to them?
Yeah. I mean, it's a numbers driven game at the base. You know, collateral value and collateral obviously pay a big decision in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, typically in my, you know, I'm a real estate guy, so the real estate world is all about what is underlying that. And that means that, so the balance, the principal balance, the original loan balance may have absolutely no bearing on real world values today.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my folks are working off of appraisals,
okay,
good or bad. And then taking that and information that I give them and information that they have from some of their other sources. And a lot of these guys do, you know, they're in the world.
Yeah.
So they do know brokers in the marketplace. And they do have other relationships and people that they rely on, you know, for information. And they're then analyzing that stuff down just like any buyer would be on an asset to say, you know, appraisal says $1 million. You know, we think they've overestimated completion costs by about 20%. You know, there's $100,000 in taxes outstanding, and the, you know, enterprise value for some developer, you know, is going to need to be 20%. And so we're down to, you know, 500 to 700 plus or minus.
And so they can make those real, they can make those kinds of real calculations. It's not a thing where they're just looking at what they've got on the paper and that's it.
My best clients can make that decision. Some of the ones who aren't quite so good are very much formula driven.
Yeah.
And so if it doesn't fit the brackets of the formula, then it doesn't work for them. You know, as you know, we preach time.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm working with a seller, whomever it is, I like to know that time matters to them a little bit more than money. Not that money's not important.
Sure.
And when they're looking at it saying, this time of year, we want to be done with this by December 31st. And so we're not going to mince words over 10 or 20% here or there.
Right.
And that's useful. If they're looking at it, and I mean, you know this, you know, if you're looking at their balance sheet and their non-accruals are low and their REO is low and their deposits are good and they can afford to take some stuff into REO, you know, they'll, just like anybody else, they'll sit on it for a little while in hopes that the right person might come along who's ready to pay a little bit more than somebody else.
You right.
know? And that happens. And again, I think it's a real art that sometimes I get right and sometimes I don't, to know when to push.
Yeah.
Or frankly, when to just say, you're right, the money's not there, you should own it. In a foreclosure setting, that is, you know,
right.
when they're a bidder and they're looking at taking this thing into REO.
Right. So yeah. You talked a little bit about the information that you provide, and I want to talk about that. I want to dive into that a little bit, because I think a lot of times people think they're going to call up and it's kind of a one and done, like the very, very transactional about it. And what I try to preach is that there's got to be a value add. Like there's got to be some reason you're involved in this transaction. And otherwise get out of here. You know, I mean, I guess it's one thing if you're coming in as an investor and you're looking to, you know, relieve them of a property. Maybe you're a friend of the family, and so what you bring to the table is that they trust you and they know you have money and they know you're gonna act and all that. But then as a service provider, someone who's getting commissions in there, talk a little bit about the value add that you bring that has people come back to you so that you've sold 10,000 properties.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to if you're not making their life easier, then they don't need you. I mean, you're just an expense. And if all you're doing is hurting their bottom line at the end of the day,
right.
You're taking $1 or $100 million out of their pocket that they should be putting back into the balance sheet.
Maybe the best way to do this is like walk us through a typical engagement. If somebody, a bank comes to you and they want to hire you to, or they're not sure if they want to hire you, but they've got an asset, it's got to go. Walk us through what happens.
Yeah, I mean, we not to be flippant about it, but we can sell almost anything. Doesn't mean that we should. And so, if somebody introduces a project to us, the first thing that we do is try to understand the four corners of the page. What is it? Where is it? What's the situation with the borrower? You know, do you own it? Is this a foreclosure? What kind of process are we dealing with? How's that all going to come and play through? Once we've understand kind of where we are in the four corners, then it's somewhat about our process is all about buyers and time. And so my whole program is designed to make sure that anybody and everybody who's in the marketplace for a piece of real estate like what we have knows about it. And we build a very tight campaign. When I say campaign, lots of marketing and advertising behind that. You know, unlike a most brokers, I mean, you know, I'm doing out of my office sales throughout New England. And so I know a little about a lot of different territories, and have a lot of different connections that I've built over 10 years for folks. But on any given moment, there's a handful or a bushel full of buyers that I don't know. And so I want to make sure that I've been very public in what I do, and they know that they can buy a former gas station in Rockland, Massachusetts on Thursday. You know, I'm
Let
reaching
me
out, and we
ask you
do
to
that in a
pause there for one second because I want to dive into one thing that you said because you just said that and you have been at it for a while and you have been out there doing deals for so long. How much does the existing list or your existing book of investors and buyers that you know, how much does that come into play in your sales? Like, how often are you selling to them? How often are they bidding on, you know, assets, people who you already know versus folks who you're pulling in new off of new marketing? I don't know if you have a
Yeah,
feel
I
for that.
mean, month to month, probably 40 to 60% of the time. We've got kind of regular investors who are looking at things and participating in auctions that we're doing. You know, and I think this is part of the service that I bring to buy to sellers is that I do have a network of investors that are always looking for an opportunity, and we'll chase, you know, and some guys are chasing multifamily, some guys are chasing residential, some guys only want industrial warehouse, you know, and at any given moment I may or may not have something for them, but when I do, I make sure that they know about it. You know, and again, this comes back, I think, to the fairness issue that you and I have talked about in the past, which is that, you know, if I call you with an opportunity and you're a regular investor of mine, I'm working for the seller. But I need you because I need a buyer. And I will make sure that you know about opportunities. But I also have a lot of guys who call me on a regular basis, basically looking to steal things. And that's a hard balance. Nobody, my seller clients are unemotional guys, and understand that a lot of what we do is wholesale. and that there's profit built into the pricing for people, and there's risk too, and that they don't chagrin somebody the opportunity of making some money on a transaction, but what they can't do is that you can't take an asset that works at 100 grand and net you $20,000 or $30,000 at the end of the transaction and come at me and tell me you only want to pay 10 for it.
Right.
I don't have time for that. And nor does the seller.
Right.
But if there's a real opportunity at 100 and the seller's given up a lot to do that, but at the end of the day they're ready to let it go, you as a buyer need to be happy at the 100 and not beat me up over $10,000. And I have those relationships all the time. And that, that's a real balance.
Right.
Because I also have a lot of guys that call me on a regular basis, what are you looking for? Everything. Anything I can get a good deal on. And it's like,
that's never a good qualifier. A good qualified investor, is it?
No.
No. It's like a huge red flag. We buy anything. No, you don't. You talk about buying anything.
You need to know what you're looking for. You need to know where your numbers work. It's a business.
Yeah.
You got to get out and grind the pavement every day, and you're not going to get rich on one transaction.
Right.
You're going to make a nice living on a bunch of work that you do. It's still work. It's not a hobby.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So let's talk about. I want to get into what makes a good auction seller, but I want to talk a little bit because I think it's important. I feel like a lot of times when you and I were working together, we get an assignment, right? They send an appraisal or whatever it is that they have. That's typically how it begins, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we typically gather some. We look at the seller to provide us with as much information as they can, that whatever's in their file. And again, most of these, I'm working with banks and REO managers or bankruptcy trustees, those kind of guys. And so they do typically, they have to do some level of, they either have access to a file or have to, from the court standpoint, get some documentation
right
from an independent third party,
And so then when you come back, you've got a little bit of information. Does it just then go into, let's walk people through so they understand what the process looks like? Because it's not, they just call you up and you go out and now you've got the thing on your website and you're selling it. There's, let's talk about kind of the proposal process where you do first, some due diligence up front, you bring your proposal and on down the road, because I don't know that people understand that there's kind of a model like that, and there's some protocol in how things are handled with an institutional client versus, with a private seller.
Yeah. And I think it depends on where you go and what auction company you're looking at. I work hard to go look at everything that I'm proposing on before I propose on it.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I have much different perspective once I've seen an asset than just looking at it on paper or
right.
Google Maps,
Yeah.
I don't get to everyone, but I try hard to do that. And from there, then that colors my opinion about where I believe the buyer is coming from my experience over the years. Is this a local play? Is it regional? Is it national? And how much advertising do I need to do to make sure that those people know what's going on?
Right.
And it's not necessarily just asset size. I mean, the Broadlux is a big asset, but chances are your buyer for, proper for a development like that is in the greater Boston area.
Right. I should mention the Broadlux was a 44-unit downtown Boston luxury condo development that failed, and we liquidated it eventually. Second pass,
that was
right?
Like a while. Yeah, three times, I think.
Three times, yeah.
And that's the other thing I think that's important as an example. I mean, look, I follow a lot of podcasts and webinars and listen to a lot of successful people, and I don't get every deal done on the first try.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for folks to know who are in this business that you ain't going to get it all. You ain't always going to get it done. The cliche is a cliche on purpose. It's kind of like making sausage someday.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I think if we – just talk about in broad strokes what happened with that deal. That so this is a I forget what size credit it was, but it was a lot. It was 20 million or 40 million or something like that. We began the process, and I believe they filed, right?
So we marketed a foreclosure auction.
Marketed a foreclosure auction, and they filed bankruptcy at the 11th hour, I believe. Right? Pushed us out. I think all told, beginning to end, that was somewhere between 18 and 24 months just to get to sale, wasn't it? I mean, we got pushed. Did we get pushed
Well, then
twice?
we went to sa then we went to sale with the whole development as a development opportunity, and the
Right.
bank bought it back.
Right.
And then the bank finished the development, which,
Sort of.
yeah, I mean,
I mean,
they
I guess.
built it out,
Yeah.
and hired a contractor and became the developer,
Right.
which is, I've seen it a couple of times. I think it was a bold move on the bank that, at the end of
Yeah.
the day, paid off.
Right.
And
Did
but
it?
from their perspective, I think they did better than they would have done if they'd sold it at auction that day.
Yeah,
I think from a
perhaps.
net standpoint,
Yeah.
and then so then the third time after they finished it, we auctioned individual units, and so we take all 44 units to auction, plus or
There
minus
might have
took
been some
everything.
pre-sales or something, but I'm pretty sure we sold. And then and actually we didn't get them all done at the auction, and we then had to shake the rest of it out over another 60 days or something like that.
Right, so we sold half of them, 60% at the auction, and then we sold the remaining, 10 or 12 units, really kind of brokerage style, but
Right.
with more tight terms and timelines than most brokers would do,
Right. But at the end of the day,
so.
we're talking about commissions on whatever that ended up being, 20 million or
22,
22 million, something like
I
that.
think $22 million.
Right.
And so if I could do that once a year, I would do that.
That'd be okay. Yeah. Yeah. So you got to hang in there. I mean, that's kind of the point of this is that they've got a process that they've got to get through. You've got to help counsel them as you move through it with them so they can make good decisions. And if you're providing that value, then yeah, sometimes it takes a little while, but it's worth it because I mean, how many other sizable deals have gone the same way? So it's anyway.
Yeah, that's a war story. But back to kind of process. And so, we're very information intensive. And I think that's a kind of an important piece of from a buyer's perspective. But also when you're shopping for stuff, you need to be. We're very transparent on purpose, and I think that's somewhat useful from a from an investor standpoint. When you're shopping for deals direct, if you've got direct connections and you're looking at notes or you're looking at REO, provide we put together a very comprehensive information package for people that shows them as much information as we can. We pull all the public records together for them, assessment information, taxes, square footages, anything that we can, find that any buyer would really want to get their arms around the property. We put
Yeah.
that in our property information package, aka PIP, not to be confused with the PIP for hotels, but and then we also regularly provide people with title rundown or title report so that they know whether, they're buying something with hair on it that they're going to need to resolve, and if they do, how they're going to handle that. And again, that's another skill set. If you can, if you have the appetite to handle properties with title issues, there's some deals out there that you can, get. If you've got a partner or an attorney, law firm, that you can work with who will do those, resolve those things for you. Typically, they can be resolved, but it can be time and sometimes can be expensive. So you're not going to be, you want to try to do a deal where you can get an attorney who's going to work for you as a partner and not as an hourly fee basis,
Yeah.
So, and then we want, we, my goal is to make sure that people stand at the auction, whether it be live, sealed bid, or online, prepared to raise their hand or click bid as many times as they possibly can and get as close to their maximum as possible.
Right.
And we use competition to do that. I like auctions. We can get into that. That's a whole other discussion about why auctions work. I mean, I'm not going
Well,
to go there
actually,
today.
I'd like to go there. Let's talk about when should someone consider an auction or selling at auction.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of gray area, but I think there's really two obvious choices for me. One is when you've got an asset that you just don't want to own anymore, and you've got room to let it go, and you've got something else to do with that money that makes you anxious to be done with it. And that's, this time of year, if somebody calls me, we want to be done by December 31st. We're a good solution for that. And I will go out and find what all the money is. I don't know what it is, but I'll go find you all the buyers who are in the marketplace today. And you tell me you want 100, and I got four bidders at the auction, and the high bid is 75,000. You are going to think hard about that 75, because you're going to look at it and say that 75 today is worth more to me than 100 in April of 2014.
Right.
When you got a lot of people beating down your door for a project, and we then use the auction process to bring competition to the plate to drive people to say, this is now we're transparent, now we're open, now you get to get face to face with the competition, and you get to say, I'll pay a million, I'll pay a million one, a million two, a million three, and from that standpoint, if you've got a project that has a lot of desirability for whatever reason, and you've got multiple offers on the table, there's no better process than an auction to make sure you eke out all the money.
Right. So it's really about when you need it now. It's about the time. It's about having, you'll sacrifice 10 or 20%, maybe even a shade more in order to be able to have it right now.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it and I say, look, if you're looking at the scales and you're thinking money's, this is money and this is time you got to be time heavy. Meaning I need my money today. If you look at me and say, I'd like it today, but if I own it in June of 2014, I got options, I may not be the best solution for you. I may be, but I'll give you candid counsel about whether I think I can be quote unquote successful for you, whatever success might be.
So once someone's decided that they're an auction seller, or maybe banks and is an auction seller, we never know who's going to watch these videos. How do you make sure that they're getting the most money at the auction that they can?
It's an interesting question. And there, I think this rolls back to kind of types of pricing for auctions.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people really know that there are kind of three types of sales. There's absolute or without, regardless of price, which means mm-hmm. you're going to sell for $1, $100, or $100 million, whatever the bid is that day. The other end of the spectrum is what I call subject to seller confirmation, which means you as a seller have the right to accept or reject the high bid at the auction, whatever it is.
Right.
The middle ground is some hybrid of the two. We'll sell regardless of price at or above minimum of $360,000. And so I don't do many absolute or regardless of price auctions because there are parts of the country where you can't get an auctioneer to do a sale without it. It's just the way that, if you go to South Carolina or Kansas and you're selling farmland, I mean, that stuff's all absolute, and not, most auctioneers won't take your listing unless you're ready to let the market tell you what they want to pay. And it works. Absolute works because people know that they can't miss that opportunity.
Right.
So you get people there who know they can't miss the opportunity, and you get 3, 5, 10, 15, 20 bidders. Those are your buyers, and they're going to drive it to the price that's fair and reasonable today.
How many bidders do you need to feel like you've got all the money?
At an absolute auction?
At any auction. How many? Yeah. How many? What number of bidders makes you feel like, okay, we're there?
There's no answer to that question. I've had very successful auctions with one bidder, and I've had very unsuccessful auctions with 10.
Yeah.
Typically I want to see 3 to 12 bidders,
Three, yeah.
depending
so
on
you
the
like
asset.
At least.
If you get you get 20, 25 bidders at an auction, that's enormous in my world. You know?
All done.
You know, and people will show up and say, like, there's only two people here. I mean, again, back to process and what we do, you know, you may, during the marketing period and the buyer due diligence time, I may have talked to 45 people. I may have shown the property to 12. And at the end of the day, only two show up. Those are your two buyers that day. And part of that means that some of the guys may not be able to perform under the terms. I mean, this goes back, you know, we don't give a lot of contingencies. And depending on the setting, we give everything from none, meaning you're buying on an as-is, where-is basis, and you're going to put 10% down, and you're going to close come hell or high water,
right?
Or lose your deposit. Two, you know, we'll give you a contingency for a title, meaning the seller needs to be able to convey good and marketable title, and if there are title defects, we'll take that on. For some properties, you know, I've sold a portfolio of gas stations recently. We're giving those guys an opportunity to review from an environmental perspective, and the seller is willing to fix any issues that come up. But it doesn't mean you don't have to close. So you find out that there's an issue. The seller says, that's okay, I'll take care of the issue, but you still have to own it. And so there are some folks who just can't perform under those terms. They need financing. You know, they just don't have the stomach to do as is, where is. They don't have the experience to analyze the asset or the marketplace enough to know that, you know, a lot of guys want to tie projects up, then do their due diligence, and then renegotiate price. And I don't, those aren't my buyers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you get
banks don't
two
like
bidders,
that. Getting tied up and renegotiated.
Can't renegotiate.
You know?
It doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but very rarely
do
my clients have much appetite for, unless something, you know, big comes up that people didn't know about, nobody knew about, then, you know, they don't have a lot of appetite for a guy that bids 500 and then calls the next day and says, I'm not going to make my deposit increase. We require people to put some money down at the auction and then typically increase to 10% of the purchase price within 5 days.
Yeah.
You know, when a guy calls 24 hours later and says, I'm not making my deposit increase unless you knock 100 grand off the price, it's a pretty short conversation in my world.
Right. Yeah. Next. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so from that standpoint, you know, I'm, that's why I do more reserve auctions than I do absolute, because if I only have one bidder, if I have one interested party at an auction with a check for $25,000 and a seller who's motivated to sell, I can usually put together a deal that everybody can walk away somewhat unhappy with, which is successful.
Right.
Buyer pays a little more than they wanted to. Seller gives up a little bit more than they wanted to. They sign an as-is contract that's going to close in 45 days with 10% hard. You know, that's a good deal in my world.
Right.
And I can do that with one guy with a reserve auction.
So we were talking about how to get the most money at an auction as a seller. And so are there some other components that go into that? Other than picking how you're gonna post it, you know, absolute with reserve, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, I think the easy analysis is that, you know, there are some simple things that everyone should do when you're preparing any piece of real estate for sale, and that can go everywhere from just making sure it looks good to taking care of title issues that you may or may not have, fixing that easement that's not quite well defined with your neighbor, taking away question marks, you know, those kind of simple things. Simple is a pretty broad word, but things that can be solved, you should really try to solve those things, because anything that you leave as a question mark for people will be a big deal. If the property has maintenance issues, get a quote, get a price on the maintenance, on the roof repair, on the whatever. You don't necessarily have to do the work, but if you can provide somebody with a range for costs, it's going to be $8,000 to $12,000. They can feel comfortable with that and not have to budget $25,000 for a complete roof redo. You know,
right?
You know, we And so we work with sellers on that level to make those kind of recommendations to say, these are the things you should do. If you got a bad tenant, get rid of your tenant.
Right.
Better than, you know, or you cannot, but you're basically putting that burden on somebody else, and they're going to want to get paid for their for taking on that burden.
Right, and you're going to get a discount on there. Yeah.
I want a discount, you know. I'll take your problem on, but I want a discount for your problem.
So
you know, I think that goes back to the piece that before I forgot to kind of finish my thought and
Sure.
went off on a tangent. But, I mean, I think from a buying perspective, you should be willing most of the time to show your seller your analysis. If it's a fair analysis, and again, nobody's going to chagrin you the opportunity to make some money, you know, but if it's a fair analysis, you should provide them with comps. You should provide them with the information that you've done so you can say, look, I know you think that this multifamily in Bridgeton is worth $35,000 a unit, but let me show you the three properties that have sold in the last 90 days for an average of $17,000 a unit.
Right.
And this is why I'm pricing it this way, you know. And if you can, you know, if and again, you can build in some entrepreneurial profit for your time, but if it's at $17,000 a unit and you're making them an offer at $2,000 a unit, it's a pretty short conversation.
Yeah. So I want to get, I know we're running into about an hour, and so we're going to probably get this wrapped up. But what I have a couple of things that I wanted to ask first. One's a quick aside, and then I want to talk about how does a buyer make sure they're getting the best deal at an auction. And then we'll talk about how people can contact and or work with you if they like. And so, but the aside that I want to ask about, I've got to ask you about this because you hear about proof of funds a lot in this business. You're always hearing proof of funds. How often are you or your sellers, your banks, how often are you, is that getting a proof of funds and considering a proof of, how often is that something that's some intricate part of your, or rather important part of your deal that's going to be required for doing a deal?
And when you say proof of funds, do you mean like the ability to show that they have all the money? Meaning like you're going to buy an asset for $250,000. I want you to show me you've got the $250,000.
Yeah, so the so there's this thing that it's like almost like an internet meme, but I hear it over and over again in the space from my subscribers, and it's not something I've personally dealt with, where they are under the impression that if they're going to contact a lender or do a deal with a lender, that the lender is going to be expecting them to provide a proof of funds letter.
Never.
Never.
So
10,000 bank transactions, you've never dealt with one. Yeah.
No, I mean, there have been some buyers who have provided me with their personal financial statements.
Yep.
As a mechanism to prove their reputation.
In a negotiated in a negotiating situation, not in when it's not going at auction. Is that what you're
right.
talking about?
You know, to say, look, for example, we get people who make a run at something pre-auction.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of chatter pre-auction. I'm going to make you an offer. You know, and I'm happy to take auctions offers pre-auction. But
when you can.
It needs to be, yeah, I mean, in some places you can't. Thank you for saying that. Foreclosure yeah. sales, you know, I'm working for a bank. They can't sell it to you ahead of time. But
right.
If I'm working for an owner and they own it, or a bank with REO, they'll sell it to you ahead of time. But it needs to be at a price point to which it makes sense for them to let it go and cancel the auction. So basically shut down any momentum that they've built to put it under contract with you. And so in those situations, for a guy who portrays, I've got the money, I will sometimes say to them, that's cool, prove it. You know, show me that my guys should basically shut it down, stop any momentum that they've built up, and we'll have to, if you don't perform, they'll have to spend money again to build that momentum.
Right.
And so show me that you say you can do this and close in 7 days. If you're going to close in 7 days on a $500,000 transaction, you really got to have the money in the bank.
Right.
And
right.
so prove it.
Right. Give me 10% now. Show me a, you know,
Put 50 grand non-refundable down, put 100 grand non-refundable down that says, like, you're a real guy. I mean, we make people come to the auction with some significant certified check, whether that be cash or a bank check. And that ranges anywhere from, you know, $5,000 to 100 grand. And if you can show up at a property sale that I'm doing with a certified, with a bank check for 100,000 bucks and you bid $1 million, your 100 grand that went hard when you're the high bidder is enough proof for me that you're real.
Right. Right.
Some of these guys, that's all the money they had, and then they're hustling to get it, you know, afterwards, and that's okay. I'm not going to chagrin them that, but if you can't get your the other 900,000 between the auction day and 45 days later, you're going to lose 100 grand.
Right.
And that's a nobody wants to lose 100 grand. Nobody wants to lose 10% of whatever the purchase price is.
Right.
And I would, you know, I mean, of the stuff we put under contract, and I think year over year we sell probably on average something like 80 to 90% of the stuff we take to auction.
Yeah.
Of that, you know, 80 of those properties that go under contract, 95% of 98% of them close without much hiccup, you know.
Right.
So you the proof of funds thing, no, I don't make people do it in my world. You know, and there's ways around it. You know, go find a hard money lender who will provide you with a, you know, basically a pre-qual letter. Shows that you're prepared to do the transaction. You know, you, if you don't have those partners and you don't have the cash, you need the money. You got to go borrow the money from somebody. So you might as well make those relationships ahead of time. So when you call them and say, hey, I'm making a run at this asset. I'm making an offer of $300,000. I'm going to pay it 60% down with you. Show me a note that tells them I'm qualified for 240 and can close in 10 days.
Right.
If you don't have that relationship already, you need to go find it to you know, especially if you're chasing a bunch of deals and you're dealing with people who don't have a lot of time to vet you and you don't have a relationship with them initially, it may help you to be able to show them that, like, I say I can close in 21 days, and this is how I'm going to do it.
Right, but it's not an integral part of every bank transaction by any means. So I want to
talk
about another. Right, not mine either. But it's funny how much people get hung up on that, and I get emails from people, and they want to know, well, you know, I need to get a POF before I can make the call to the bank. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, pick up the phone, make a connection, you know, see if you can find a deal, and then find out what they're going to need from you along the way. You know, you can fill in the gaps. So I wanted to ask you about you've sold some notes, and when I want to talk about in the situations you've been in, what was the decision point that they were going to do that instead of go forward with a foreclosure and try and sell it then, or to book it back in? What kind of weighed in there? Why did they do it as opposed to any other disposition method?
Yeah, I mean, some of it I think is cultural. There are some of my clients who like to sell notes, and there are clearly some of them that don't.
Yeah.
You know, I think the chain of assets is interesting from a note sale perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more banks, in my experience, are willing to sell a note on a loan that has no personal guarantee, or has a borrower who's, you know, filed bankruptcy and essentially is judgment proof at this point.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, there's really no additional recovery for them after they foreclose. So to play that example out, let's do easy numbers. Let's say they have a note for 100 grand and an asset that's collateralized by a piece of property that's worth 60. There's no personal guarantee. There's no additional assets from that borrower. You know, the chances that they would be willing to sell that note for a discount rather than take the time and energy to foreclose on that asset are pretty good. Same example, they got a note for 100 grand, they got an asset worth 60, but they got a personal guarantee, and the borrower is relatively solvent with some other assets. They'd be more inclined to foreclose that asset, that note, sell the asset for what they can get, and then go chase the deficiency, whatever that might be, from the borrower, because they know that there is probably likelihood that they'll get some, all, or a piece of what the difference is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a really good point. And I should point out that a lot of the stuff that you and I are talking about here is we're talking in the commercial world. So we're,
Yeah, I mean, I do some residential sales and I sell some residential properties, but my residential properties are really, more of a commercial standpoint, the developer kind of stuff. We do some true residential work that had a homeowner who was living in it before, but yeah, I mean, more of my guys are commercially oriented than they are
Yeah,
residential.
maybe we should have said that at the beginning, but I
Yeah,
think,
sorry. Maybe
yeah.
you can edit that back in the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to do two more quick things. One is, how does a buyer make sure that they get the best deal at auction, and to make sure that they don't overpay? Let's address that.
The don't overpay thing is don't get overexcited. Be a business person about it. It's a business transaction. I mean, look, if you're there and it's a lakefront property in Wolfboro and your family had a house there eons ago and you're just desperate to get back in there and you got the money, then you do whatever you want. Overpay by as much as you possibly want to, because
Right.
long term, to you, it's more about the life than it is about the transaction,
Right.
but if it's a single family home that you're going to renovate and flip, you need to know what your numbers are, and you really need to be pretty analytical about that. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have some flexibility, and so, because you don't want to lose it for $1,000. So
Right.
you come saying, I want to bid 95, and it looks like you bid 94, somebody else bid 95. You ought to bid 96 just to make sure that you don't lose it. And I do that when I buy some stuff. I don't buy what I sell, but I go to auctions, and I've been a bidder. And you can't be so rigid that you don't have some flexibility on what you're going to do. Back to how to get the best deal. I mean, I gotta
Should you
say,
wait to the end and then throw in a bid right at the end?
I mean, that's a whole strategy thing about what you want to do. And
Of
I mean,
people.
I'm a guy who goes personally, and this is a personal decision. I mean, I'll go to auctions. I like auctions. I go because I want to be a bidder. I don't want to stand there and wait and find out what everybody else wants to do.
Right.
I'm an active participant. I mean, I do a lot of auctions, and I'll tell you, I have a lot of guys standing there, like this when I'm going looking for 100. Anybody 100 now? 100. Anybody 100? And
Yeah.
nobody wants to open.
And then you
Being
sell
the
it for
first guy to,
six.
being a guy to open it at 100 grand on a $500,000 asset, like, you're not gonna buy it for 100. Like,
Right.
you might as well just play, have some fun with it,
Right.
and so from that standpoint, I think I'll just back you up. I mean, if your goal is to be a bottom feeder and only buy things that you can steal, you're not gonna buy a lot of stuff. And so again,
In
you
any
got to do your
environment,
work.
really.
You got to do your work. You got to know the asset. You got to know what your profit margins are. It's a business. And if it fits your business model, it doesn't matter. I mean, so you can go to an auction where there are six bidders, right? And I got a seller that wants 500 grand, and the high bid stops at 310. Everybody else is a bottom feeder, and you're looking at it going, man, I pay 400. And I come over to you and say, look, I got to tell you, I got a seller who wants 500 now. You know that you would have paid up to 400 for it, but the bidding stopped at 310. If you tell me, look, the bidding stopped at 310, I'll pay you 315. I'm never going to get that deal done. But if you look at me and say, Mike, I'm comfortable at 400. I can do that, but I'm not going to go higher than that. Your guy needs to come down. I'll work hard to put that transaction together. Sometimes it doesn't matter about what everybody else wants to do. If it's a transaction, I mean, look, I want you to make money too, and when I'm a buyer, I want to make money too. But again, if you don't buy anything, you're never going to make any money. And
Right.
so to stand there and say, to let a deal go by that you could make money on because the public bidding only went to 315, whatever, to whatever number, I hope I'm making sense. When you would pay more, and know that you can make that work, you ought to, the guys I know who have been successful doing this for years and years are willing to ignore everybody else and say, this works for me. I'm in, Mike. Let's do it. Let's do it at 400. Screw the rest of these guys. You know, I'm done.
Right.
So you're saying I'll go to my seller and say,
someone's at an auction, they're looking at it, doesn't look like you know, you do the abba-dabba-doo, and then it doesn't look like you're going to sell it. It's not out of line. I mean, they should walk up to you and say, hey, I'm still interested in this. Can we do a thing? They should say that probably before you walk away. Is that right?
Yeah, they should. You know, because just with a buyer, you know, look, you're there to buy. And frankly, with my seller, the seller's there to sell. And so, you know, that's the best opportunity to make a deal. If you and I know, you go home, you let everybody think about it, things change.
Right.
And so you may miss an opportunity. And again, I mean, you can chase a lot of deals. And if you're out chasing a lot of deals and it always seems like you're getting outbid by somebody else, either your formula doesn't work, you could be using hard money and they've got cash and that's, you know, going to be a challenge. You're too conservative,
right?
And you need to loosen up a little bit.
Yeah,
you're missing it somehow. So everybody else is making money. Now, look. I've had people overpay for stuff.
Sure.
So, you know, you want to be sensitive about that. And I don't want people to overpay because, frankly, at the end of the day, if I sell it to you and you lose money on it, what are your chances of coming back to my next auction?
Right.
You know, and so I want you to be a happy buyer. And I want you to come and say, Mike, that was awesome. What's next? You know,
yeah.
I made money. Where's the next deal?
Right.
So.
Well, cool. So I want to know, I want to tell everybody how people can work with you. Just to give you a cross section of who we have here, you know, we have some acquisitions, firms and funds, you know, small funds and this sort of thing. I have a lot of brokers. I have a lot of note brokers, have a lot of REO brokers, and don't have a lot of auctioneers. I have a few auctioneers, but don't have a lot of auctioneers, which I guess is the case. Anyway,
there are lots of us, thank God. I mean, you know,
yeah.
It's a good niche.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So how can let's just kind of go through those groups. How can brokers work with you?
Yeah, I mean, we regularly partner with brokers, you know, either providing them some referrals for folks who aren't quite ready to go to auction.
So you'll actually refer sales to them if they're in the area and you know them. Okay.
Yeah, folks are better, you know, some properties are better listed.
Yeah.
They're just not simple enough for auction. They've got, you know, and so I'll regularly say, you should really talk to Justin about putting this on the market for a while. We do the reverse with folks who either have, you know, sellers who are saying, you know, I'm ready to sell, but are having a hard time accepting what the market's ready to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And so need a bit of the process, need to know, you know, brokerage, and I think most brokers would admit this, the biggest challenge with brokerage is the opacity. You know, it's not transparent all the time, and so it's subject to, you know, people get squirrely about, oh, you're selling this to your brother, or this is your partner, or you're a buyer, you know, and I'm very transparent, and so we do very well in situations where you're just wondering if the seller's wondering if they've got all the money, and so we pay referral fees back to brokers. We always pay broker participation in our auctions and fight with our clients regularly to make sure that if a broker brings a buyer that there's skin in the game for the broker.
So I have there's a lot of brokers out there who are who are subscribers and members who are calling banks. If they're calling banks and they think they've uncovered an auction opportunity, should they reach out to you?
Yeah.
And so where would you be for that? Like what kind of territory are you talking about? Where would you be happy to receive a call from? Yeah.
Oh,
I want to give folks the
anyone.
Idea of your footprint.
Yeah. You're talking to me in Portland, Maine today.
Yep.
I live in Portland. I love this little city. It's the right place for me. I personally do sales in New England and New York. And then I have partners with offices around the country. And we do, you know, I'm involved in transactions right now in Georgia, Florida, Texas, Virginia. I don't want to do every sale in those areas. So typically, if you've got clients who are in the Northeast, I want to know about them. If you've got transactions and you've got a deal in Tennessee, I may just put you in touch with my partner from Transon who's in Knoxville.
Right. So, but basically, anywhere you are in the country, you're going to have somebody they can talk to who's an auctioneer?
Yeah, we've got, right now, and we've got 20 offices around the country and 100 auctioneers that can help you with almost anything in any given area. We have some holes. If you have a property in South Dakota, I don't have a lot of coverage.
I think everything's selling there anyway. Actually, it probably would be a good place for an auction right now because from what I understand, it's going like hotcakes. Some kind of oil boom happening out there.
Yeah, exactly.
So brokers can call you, they can, and you'll pay them commissions if they bring someone to the sale most of the time. You'll pay them referral fees if they have someone who should be selling at auction. Am I missing anything else? Oh, and you'll refer properties that are best left to be listed to them. So that's...
Yeah, I mean, I talk more people out of auctions than I talk into them probably.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I remember.
Yeah.
So who else should contact you and how should they do it?
I always obviously want to hear, the general profile of my best client, direct client, is an unemotional seller with repeat business. And so we've been doing more work with, folks who have been buying pools. Whether that be notes or REO, we typically help them. We're best suited to help them at two points, either early, when they just acquired, a bunch of notes, and they're trying to sort through what the best exit is for those. And so we'll provide them some analysis on, which properties we feel like are valuable. We frankly, do some direct buying, and we buy some notes and some real estate here and there. We kind of refer to it, frankly, sometimes as buying an auction, because a lot of times we'll just take those and reposition them, and we do a little bit of workout, but a lot of times we'll foreclose and sell that stuff ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We also do a lot of work for folks who are dealing with the end of a tape, who have set up, worked through the majority of this. I've made my money and I'm stuck with these 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 pieces. What do I do with them? I'd like to move on, put this one behind me and move on to my next lineup. And so we work a lot with those folks. We do have some notes to sell. It's not my primary business, as investors, we also are brokers sometimes, and so have some opportunities for people. Who else? Buyers.
Banks.
I mean, we
buyers. Yeah.
Always want to hear from a client. If you're a client, if you're in the workout world, if you're in the distressed world, if you're a servicer for a CMBS portfolio, that's 80% of the work that I do is with somebody like you.
And so, how should they reach you?
I am. M. Carey, Carey, at transon.com. That's TRAN as in Nancy, Z as in zebra, ON.com, transon.com. You can always call me here in the office, which is 866-503-1212, or my mobile, which is 207-776-1936.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you coming on here and talking through some of this with me. I could go on talking about I could do war stories with you for a while, but I guess maybe that's just for you and me. But I do appreciate you coming on here, and I feel like you brought a lot of light to what's happening kind of behind the scenes for them, and also probably it's a good education on auctions in general, being on both sides of the real estate auction. So it's been great, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Mike. Thanks. Bye.